If you were on social media this past weekend, you might have seen some users who were really upset over a new policy.
Instagram decided to remind us just how much they suck with their latest update.
Now, the new default setting will limit the political content you might otherwise see.
Meta is literally censoring political topics off of Instagram and Facebook.
This comes just a couple weeks after the House passed a bill that aims to ban TikTok if the company doesn't change owners.
Foreign adversaries like the Chinese Communist Party pose the greatest national threat of our time.
It seems like everyone, or at least everyone's mom, wants to rein in the power of social media. They're worried about their data being stolen, or the election being influenced by propaganda, or about their kids' brains being fried. Jay Caspian King, a staff writer at The New Yorker, shares some of those concerns. But at the same time, he believes that access to social media is a First Amendment right, even if we're accessing it way too much.
I think that the structure of the internet, of all social media, is to argue about politics. And I think that is baked into it, and I don't think you can ever fix it.
You're listening to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. In your latest column, you wrote that we should resist a society in which every human interaction gets processed through an algorithm and broadcast out to a frequently nasty public. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what this resistance to social media has looked like over the years and how it has evolved.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's two levels of it. The first is happening on the sort of official government level, right, where there have been all these attempts to regulate social media companies. And I think for, you know, almost the entirety of his reign as the CEO of Facebook, for example, now Meta, Mark Zuckerberg has been just routinely hauled in front of Congress. I mean, you know, it's almost like a clock, right? Like, there he is in front of Congress again. And so those efforts have not really yielded too much in the way of regulating social media. And there's some very good reasons for that, right? Like, I'm not sure if the Congress or the government is really should be doing any of this. But on the individual level, I think that some of what inspired me to write about this and is actually, you know, something I write about quite a bit is that I generally find it odd that there is so little resistance on a personal level, right? Or even on a small community level to these types of devices and to social media generally.
Like we expect the government to do it instead of just doing it ourselves?
Right. That there isn't, like, for example, phone-free communes, right? Like, I only say that, like, partially facetiously. Like, there is not social movements to really get yourself away from the internet. And I've thought for a long time about why that is, because it just seems so natural that, you know, this thing is taking over people's lives, that people generally have a negative impression of it and an increasingly negative perception of it. And that generally when those types of things happen, those conditions present themselves and you see little pockets of people who consciously object to it and push themselves away. And yeah, I just have not seen too much of it. You know, I am personally invested in trying to find it because I feel like I would join such a society, right, at some point. But yeah, there's not much to it. And that the question of why has been really interesting to me.
So when you talk about, like, phone-free communes or something of that kind, I mean, it seems like what you're referring to is sort of the way in which social media has destroyed our attention spans. But when we think about the way that social media is talked about by the government, usually the conversation is centered around misinformation and, you know, at least in the case of TikTok, potential national security concerns. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little to how these are different concerns or whether you think that the misinformation stuff is actually more of like a Trojan horse for the actual concern among parents, which is just that these phones and computers and apps are kind of ruining their kids' lives and to some extent.
Right. Yeah, I do think there's two levels to that critique, right? The first is basically what you said, which is that social media is harmful for a number of reasons outside of just like one's well-being and sense of self and ability to connect with other people, that there's a sense that there's so much disinformation, misinformation on the internet, and that it is profoundly affecting political outcomes, right? So, you know, obvious example being 2016 election, there was all sorts of talk about how there were these bot farms in Estonia or whatever in Russia, and that they were tricking people into believing things that would cause them to vote for Donald Trump or to undermine democracy, etc. I personally am quite skeptical of that type of work. I don't think that social media has that much of an effect, or I think it does have an effect. I think it's generally overblown when talked about as having this sort of totalizing effect that we can explain everything via disinformation. I think one example that I've always found interesting was that there was a study done by a group of academics about misinformation in the Asian American community. And what they concluded was that the reason why Asian Americans were opposed to affirmative action was because of misinformation, which, you know, to me was kind of an outrageous claim because, you know, I think that a lot of Asian Americans felt that things like the Harvard case, for example, were showing discrimination against them, and that was why they were, that's why they opposed affirmative action, right? It felt like there's a misapplication of that term and an overexpansion of that term. And so I'm somewhat skeptical towards that part. In terms of propaganda, I think that in terms of TikTok, it's very hard to know rightfully what ByteDance or TikTok are doing. These things are quite cloudy still. But if it is propaganda, the First Amendment Supreme Court has clearly shown that Americans have the right to receive propaganda, right? And so for that reason, like, I'm not as concerned with that as well, because I think it's part of, you know, freedom of speech to say that you can receive propaganda. Basically, every single thing that people are trying to do to suppress social media networks is an infringement on the First Amendment. I think it's quite clear, right? And I don't think you don't have to be like a raving First Amendment person like I am to actually believe that. Like, it's pretty settled court stuff that says this.
Well, can you explain how that's the case? Because I guess I'm wondering, like, let's say that the government bans TikTok. You would assume that all the creators on that platform would then, you know, create YouTube Shorts and Instagram Reels. And so how is, you know, getting rid of one app or limiting one app necessarily conflicting with the First Amendment?
It's more that it is not the expression of free speech. It is the ability to receive speech. So in the article, I talk about this case called Lamont versus Postmaster General from 1965. Jamil Jaffer, who is a head of the Knight Foundation at Columbia, sort of directed me to this case because he's written about it as well. Basically, there was a man in 1965. He was a philosopher. He was a socialist, and he was trying to get a copy of something called the Peking Review, right? And this is explicit Chinese propaganda, right, from a foreign country.
Up, yeah.
There's no, like, hiding anything. It's not close. And so, but at the time, the United States had this law that if you wanted explicit foreign propaganda from a, you know, small number of countries, right, that are deemed to be hostile, that you would have to fill out a little reply card. So, like, your post office would get it and they would say, "We got this propaganda. We just really want to make sure that you want it. If you send back this reply card, then we'll send it to you," right? And so Lamont sued the Postmaster General, saying that just the act of filling out this little reply card, after which you would still get the propaganda, right, was violating his right to receive information because he would have to be putting himself essentially on a list. And the court agreed with him, right? And this is still, you know, upheld at this point. And so the right to receive propaganda, or the right to receive any type of information that you want to make those types of decisions for yourself, is part of free speech. And so eliminating something based on the threat of propaganda, right, I think is a violation of the First Amendment.
What do you think is the distinction between someone kind of like opting in to receiving a certain kind of political propaganda, you know, say choosing to subscribe to a communist magazine versus going on TikTok to see dancing videos and then the algorithm for some reason gives you propaganda of some kind?
I don't think there's a distinction, but I understand I'm in the minority. You know, part of what I've started to realize in my advancing age is that people don't really care about the First Amendment so much. And, you know, For a while, I thought they do until they don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like very, the people who like are, look, I'm not saying in any type of good way, right? But the people who are just kind of absolutists and principled about it, we're sort of dwindling in number. And so I would say there's no difference, right? And that people still have the right to do that, and they have the right to distinguish what is propaganda and what is not propaganda. And they also have the ability to just not look at TikTok, right? And so I think that those are decisions that should be left to the individual. And I think that governments trying to interfere with that is bad. However, I have a daughter, right? And I don't want my daughter to be on social media. My concern is that I don't want her on those platforms, which obviously is like a real, like, it's not particularly consistent thinking, right? Like that, just like everyone should be able to access these platforms, but not my daughter, right? It seems almost quite NIMBY-ish. And so that's the tension I think that's happening right now. And I think the question that people are need to ask, and that I think a lot of people need to ask, is, am I willing to sacrifice some civil liberties if it means that my child will not be on social media, right? Is that an okay compromise to do? I would say no, right? But I think that most people would say yes. And I think that's sort of what, I think that is a direction that we're heading in right now.
I'm wondering about like some of the smaller restrictions that states like Utah have tried to impose, calling for age restrictions and for parental controls on these apps. I'm wondering what the free speech argument or concern is there.
Oh, yeah. That's another place. So Florida passed a bill that is similar to the Utah bill in that it creates an age restriction, and it, I think, at least in Utah, it would enforce penalties on the social media company if they were out of compliance with it. The free speech argument against that is that, you know, people under the 18 also have free speech rights, right? And that social media is the public square, which is something that the court has essentially said, right? And which I think any single person who pays any attention would say is true, right? That social media has become the public square, even if it is privately owned, and that young people should have the right to access that type of stuff and make their voices heard or express their opinion about anything and not wait until they're 18. There's an additional problem with this, which is that in terms of the First Amendment, which is that to verify one's age, like how do you do that, right? In Utah, at least, you needed to provide a state ID. That means that anybody without a state ID means that everybody who cannot provide age verification in the way that the state of Utah wants is now going to also be banned from the public square, right? So it doesn't just infect children, it affects people without IDs as well.
Jay, I'd like to ask you more about your own experience on these apps and also your perception of what's driving the public discourse about them. But first, we're going to take a quick break. You'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment. If you like the show, we'd love it if you could leave us a rating and review on the podcast platform of your choice. And while you're there, don't forget to hit the follow button so you never miss an episode.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I have a confession to make, which is that I actually don't have TikTok. You know, all of the talk of the national security concerns, you know, we work in journalism. I just thought better not to have it, even though The New Yorker now has a TikTok account. So maybe I should just get over that. But I'm curious about your personal relationship with the app, since you've mentioned that you are worried about your kids, you know, kind of becoming addicted to it.
I do use it a lot. At the beginning of TikTok, I thought it was the best social media app ever because it was quite international. And yeah. I could basically train my algorithm to do stuff like watch construction workers in India who would post TikToks about what their days were like. And this was like fascinating to me. I didn't know what a, you know, Northern Indian construction worker's life was like. There was a whole bunch of sort of nature videos out of China that I found really interesting. The most popular one was like that people would sort of set up by a stream and catch a fish and cook it next to the stream. And it's like the most relaxing, beautiful thing that you will ever see. And I felt like, you know, like the sort of international component to it was going to be really eye-opening, right? And in a way, I could sort of funnel myself away from all the dancing teens for months. Like I use this app daily and I never saw any of that stuff, right? I didn't know who Charlie D'Amelio or who any of these people were. I still don't really, you know, but, you know, since then it's become much more typical, right? It's become everything, I think, is kind of funneled towards the same thing. You can't train it in the same type of way. And so, I don't know, I use it much less than I did because I find it to be frustrating. I'm like very uninterested. I'm 44 years old. Like I not out of virtue. I just can't actually physically care about a lot of this stuff that happens on TikTok. I don't know. I don't think that it's necessarily worse than YouTube Shorts. I don't think it's worse than Instagram Reels. I think there's larger questions around it, you know, at the root. But in terms of the viewer experience, like, I don't really see much difference between any of them. In fact, I think this is something that happens to almost everybody, which is that while I'm just scrolling through, I oftentimes forget which app I'm on, right? Like, yeah. I don't remember if I'm on Instagram or TikTok or YouTube Shorts. And then when I find out, I'm just like kind of surprised by what app I'm on because it's all the same, you know?
I mean, all the videos, point. Like I am, so I, as I said, I don't use TikTok, but I do watch Instagram Reels and YouTube Shorts, and I'll often send my friends videos from those platforms, and then they'll say, oh, I saw this on TikTok. So right, I'm pretty sure right. that I am basically on TikTok, even if I'm technically, I'm not. You know, since the content does seem to be, you know, quite similar among the various platforms, I mean, I'm wondering how much of the TikTok hate should we be attributing to the fact that this is a non-American company? Why is it that we are seeing so many efforts to ban TikTok, but never Meta or X?
I don't want to fully minimize the national security concerns, right? Because I think that there is something odd about the fact that so many American teenagers and young people are completely addicted to an app that won't really tell us what they're doing, right? That is quite vague about what happens to the data. And so perhaps there's a national security concern. However, I would like I said before, I would need it articulated much more clearly than it has been articulated by the people who are trying to, you know, what I see as a de facto ban of TikTok. In terms of privacy and data, I do not think that this is a particularly compelling argument for the fact, because basically all your data is already on for sale anyway, right? There are these data brokers who collect and sell people's data. China at any point could approach one of these people and they could just buy the same data, right? Unless you believe that there is some sort of special data that TikTok harvests, right? That is not keystrokes and facial recognition and your address and all the other data that is readily for sale on the open market right now, you would also have to explain to me what that special data is that only TikTok has and that, you know, you couldn't just go and buy on the open market from a data broker right now. So I don't find that reason to be particularly compelling either. But those are the two things. I just feel like they haven't been articulated in a way that is convincing to me.
So you've been on these apps for a while. How much has the content on these apps changed from your perspective over the years? Because I feel like when TikTok first came out, it was all about dancing, and now it seems to be way more focused on politics than it used to be.
I do think that since 2020 that there's been an acceleration of political content on these platforms, but I think that's probably user-driven, and that there is a virality around things like, you know, police killings or around footage from war, and that opportunistic people on these platforms are always going to use those moments as a way to promote their own brand or to get more followers or whatever, right? I think the idea that there is some sort of secret plot to promote this type of stuff to sow division, honestly, it feels very reminiscent of me of many anti-Semitic tropes that are out there, right, about how George Soros or whoever is seeding dissent within the American public through, you know, controlling the media, et cetera, right? Now, you know, in terms of TikTok and China, the reason why such theories still seem plausible to us, again, is because ByteDance, TikTok, not really clear about what they're doing. And there's a way in which they could be a little bit more transparent, and I think it would put some of these fears to rest. However, I think even if they did put these fears to rest to somebody like me, that the accusations of propaganda would still be there, right? Because obviously people make political hay at this point by criticizing China. They do these congressional hearings where they drag people in front of, you know, Ted Cruz or Tom Cotton. And, you know, that there is a theater of interrogating these social media companies, not just TikTok, you know, every social media company, and that Congress at this point and politicians, I think lawmakers, they see some political benefit of seeing themselves as being adversarial to these companies, right? Nobody wants to defend them at this point. And so within that political atmosphere, I think one of the charges that you would logically place on somebody is that you're spreading propaganda, right? But I don't know, like, what is that propaganda? Like, why would it be effective? You know, what side is it on? What, to what purpose is it, right? I will say that at the beginning of TikTok, I did feel a lot better about China because I would see these people fishing by these beautiful streams and I'd be like, oh man, that is a beautiful, that's a beautiful stream in China, you know, but that's not like a political propaganda, right? So, yeah, I don't know. I think that overall it's, I'm mostly confounded by the arguments just because I think as unclear as TikTok ByteDance is being, I think, you know, Congress not really clear about what their problem is here either.
So, Jay, I want to ask you about something I noticed over the weekend on Instagram and what it means as we head into an election season. But first, we have to take another break.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Over the weekend, I noticed on my Instagram that lots of people were upset about the fact that Meta, which is the company that owns Instagram, is now limiting content that it deems to be political. It seems like a kind of wild thing to do in an election year, and that it could have a decent impact considering that at least half of adults in the U.S. get their news at least sometimes from social media. And I'm wondering what you make of this move.
I think it's done out of a fear of litigation and a fear of what happened in 2016, right, with newsfeed and all the claims around disinformation. When Instagram launched Threads, right, which was their Twitter competitor, they said the same thing. The CEO of Instagram said that they were going to sort of de-emphasize political content. And then the question arose, well, what are we going to talk about?
It's really vapid on Threads, I gotta say.
And so what ends up happening is that anytime like a internet forum basically lays a law down and says we can't talk about the thing that everybody's talking about because it's too toxic, then people like post photos of their dogs, right? And then, you know, it's the most boring thing. I have a dog, I love dogs, but like I don't need to see everyone's dog. Especially strangers that I don't know on the internet. It's like I don't need to see your dog at all. So I think this is part of a long-term move. You know, Adam Mosseri, I think, who is the CEO of Instagram, he was also in charge of newsfeed in 2016. And I think that this narrative of how Meta, Facebook, Instagram, all these companies within the same group affect political outcomes has been an ongoing conversation within that company. And I think that generally speaking, they have decided at this point to sort of step back, right? They don't want to be a part of it. They want to sell themselves as a tech company. They still want to sell themselves as connectors or whatever, right, between people. But they don't want to be the world's news feed anymore. And I can actually understand why they feel that way. I do think that at some level, it is really going to restrict their popularity. But maybe that is like a decision that they're willing to make at this point.
It's interesting because they also say that, you know, Meta has said we won't proactively recommend content about politics on, you know, recommendation services across Instagram and Threads. But if you still want these posts recommended to you, you can kind of go into your settings and basically click a button and all of a sudden you'll see them again. And so I've been wondering if that, you know, kind of makes a difference to you when it comes to freedom of speech concerns, if you can technically press a few buttons and then make it go back to normal, or whether the expectation that people will go and proactively do this is enough to raise concerns.
I wasn't aware of that, but hearing it right now, my initial response is more of like, just a personal one. You know, like what type of sick, it's like a really fascinating psychological experiment, right?
Like it's like a reverse filter. It's very weird.
Right. Yeah. What type of person says, no, give me all the horrible stuff, you know, give me all the arguments. I would do it, but you know, I guess it's like turning Google safe search off. Right.
But it's funny that, yeah, we're at the point where we're kind of equating like political content with, content that's like, you know, sexually explicit or, you know, violent or something.
I don't think it will work. I think that the structure of the internet, of all social media, is to argue about politics. And I think that is baked into it. And I don't think you can ever fix it from it. And that basically since the beginning of the internet, people have used message boards or the connectivity or the technology that allows you to send a bunch of text from one place to another instantaneously to just argue with one another and to fight. There's never been an internet or a version of the internet that has not descended into this, right? It's all, every single forum is this, Reddit, everything. And so the idea that you could do it by trying to limit this stuff, I think is outrageous. They'll just fight in the comments, right? Or they'll fight of whatever, right? There'll be arguments everywhere.
I feel like I've noticed a bunch of this lately where there'll be like an Instagram account that, you know, posts something on Instagram, and then you'll have like a whole subreddit devoted to just like tearing this Instagram apart and debating it and whatnot. And it seems like you're right that these conversations, they're going to happen. The political conversations will happen either in the comments of the app or they'll happen on a separate app. But like it's impossible to separate the content on Instagram, even the dog photos from the rest of it, because people just seem to have a tendency to want to, you know, engage in political debate whenever they have an opportunity to.
Right. It's something I noticed this morning, right, which is something that I thought about more than I should, but you know, anytime there's a K-pop video of somebody dancing, right, an Asian person dancing, the first or second comment is always a discussion of cultural appropriation and whether it's appropriate for Asian people in Asia to be doing hip-hop dances. And they're always at the top because those are the most engaged with comments, right? There are huge arguments underneath. It's just like,
it's way better than like, hey, cool video.
Yeah. This morning it was a 10-year-old in Vietnam who was doing a dance, and that was the first comment. There's like 1,000 responses to it, right? like you can't stop it, right? Like you would think that here's a cute child dancing would be free from political conversation, but of course it immediately goes to that type of place. So I'm quite skeptical that something like that would ever work.
I'm wondering what you think content moderation should look like, if it has to exist, and if there are any platforms out there that seem to be doing a better job than others.
I don't think it should really exist, but I do think that certain things like, you know, people being killed, right, violence, depictions of sexual violence should obviously not be, there should be restrictions upon that. In terms of any type of speech or whatever, hate speech, I'm much more resistant to the idea that people should be banned from platforms or that content moderation should exist for those types of things unless they're physical threats of violence. And so, ironically enough, despite, you know, my general feelings about Elon Musk, right, I think that if you look at the totality of what has happened, especially since October 7th in terms of the war in Gaza, that there's much more free conversations about that, I think, on Twitter than anywhere else. And I think that part of that is because I think that Elon Musk's general thoughts about free speech are completely convoluted and mostly disingenuous. But I do think there's part of him which is just like, I'm not going to regulate this because I already staked myself to this position. I would probably say they're doing a better job, but that's just because I think that most things should be okay. And again, I think that's a very popular opinion. Like, I think people, like, I don't know, I'm Asian, right? Like, sometimes people on these social media platforms will call me a racial slur. It doesn't happen very often, but occasionally happens, you know? And I don't know. I think they should have the right to type that if they want without getting banned from the platform. I have the option to block them if I want, right? And so, I don't know. I think that less moderation is good.
Yeah, my problem is that I am... I guess I think really highly of myself. And so I kind of want to be able to receive all of the content, even if it's propaganda, and I trust myself to be able to tell the difference between the real stuff and the, you know, the fake stuff. You know, when we see like the memes that went viral in 2016 that apparently had some effect on the election, I'm always like, oh, that wouldn't have gotten me. I don't know. At the same time, I'm sort of like, oh, I guess it's probably not great for a 12-year-old to be, you know, looking at a bunch of like propaganda on YouTube or on TikTok. So it's like I'm like cool with other people's content being moderated. I just don't want mine to be moderated. So when you're that much of a hypocrite, you just have to be anti-moderation. Because,
you got to click that button right on Instagram, then just get it all to the, you know,
exactly.
Just smash you in the face. I think there are already safety controls for children, right? And I think those are appropriate. In reality, content moderation is done abroad, right? It is outsourced. One of the things that has always troubled me about it is the idea that some executives at a tech company are making decisions that they're outsourcing to overworked, underpaid people, say in the Philippines, who then have to watch all this stuff and enact whatever the policy is. It's a really inexact system, right? It is one that is going to have all sorts of failures throughout. And I think that the biggest failures are really at the top. And that anytime you have people who are now controlling what is generally thought of as the public square, who are just making these decisions seemingly arbitrarily, that, you know, it's probably better to just figure out a way to do it without them making those decisions, if at all possible.
You know, we talked earlier about Zuckerberg just constantly having to, you know, do these like congressional hearings and whatnot. And so it seems like they're it's less ideological. You know, we want the people on our platforms to be exposed to the right things and more just, you know, a matter of protection. I guess I'm just wondering why more of them don't take the approach of less moderation, given that it seems like it would be a good marketing strategy in some ways.
Yeah, I think they are afraid of getting hauled in front of Congress over and over again. They do see the polling that comes out about the decreasing popularity of these platforms. I think they do see things like the Utah bill as being a public move against them that is supported by large portions of the public. And they are wondering what their future looks like. And I don't think that their future can just be, they rightfully understand that their future can't just be, hey, we are not the publisher, right? And cite Section 230 and then just kind of move on with it over and over again and say like, no, this is a user doing it. It's not us. You know, this was what you saw during the Reddit days, right? The Reddit sort of asserting itself over and over saying the stuff that happens is not on them. It's on the user. It's not their fault. It's the user's fault. I found that compelling, but eventually many, many people didn't, and Reddit had to change their rules. We're seeing a large-scale version of that happening right now, and these companies, I think, are just adjusting based on risk.
So you end your latest column on a bit of a nihilistic note. Basically, you question whether we can ever actually moderate content online without infringing on the First Amendment, and whether instead we should just let the internet, quote, run wild and grow as big and stupid as it can be. That way, there's even more reason to ignore it. For those of us who care about free speech and preventing brain rot on social media, is that the only path forward?
Yeah, I think so. I think that people need to opt out and that they need to basically say that the government can't protect us from this and that they won't, and that the companies are not going to do anything that really compromises their bottom line. Right? They're not going to act judiciously, or they're not going to act in a benevolent type of way, and that we should probably stop wondering when they'll do this, right? When they'll get it right. I don't think there is a way to really get it right. And so I think that it falls on the individual or on communities to then just opt out of it. And I think that we haven't seen too much of it, but I think we'll start seeing more of it in the future, right? In the near future, I think that there will be much more emphasis on phones being damaging. I think there will be much more emphasis on people trying to live lives away from this sort of stuff. At first, it'll feel very culty, right? But I think that it's kind of necessary at this point, and that it would be a good time to keep an open mind to it, right? To different ways of existing without devices and without the internet. That's the only alternative I can think of. But, you know, I don't know. I live in Berkeley, California, so maybe it's like ingrained in me that communes are like a good way to go about life.
I have trouble picturing it in New York, but
yeah,
It would be nice to at least have the option of like an opt-out community.
Right.
It seems
right.
like right now it's like the only way to do it is just to resign yourself to being really disconnected from everything that's going on in a way that would be damaging to like your education if you're a kid or your social life or your career.
Right. Right. Parents generally want this for their kids, but they all say the same thing, which is that it's impossible because their kids enter a stage where they need it to have any friends at all. Now, there's very many different versions of it, right? Like, kids play a lot of video games online, right? And so you can't do that. They text back and forth, can't do that. I mean, you're really sort of setting your kid up for a social disaster in that type of way. Most parents, I think, rightfully don't want that. And so, it takes, I think, a community effort at that level.
Well, thank you so much, Jay.
Thank you.
Jay Caspian King is a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can read his latest column at newyorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Julia Nutter and edited by Stephanie Karayuki with production assistance from Mike Kutchman. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Enjoy your week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.